This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Francis Nally and Brandon Adamson. We're going to be discussing my career as a journalist, podcaster, and cultural icon. Great talking to you guys.
It's nice talking to you, Robert.
Hey there.
So, there is a new book out. It's called The Stark Truth with Robert Stark. A Legacy, 2009 to 2018. Francis, do you want to kind of briefly introduce that book?
You know, the first time I had this idea about a book about Robert Stark was probably at the end of last year, a few months ago, where I felt like, you know, there's a lot of people that don't take credit that Robert Stark has been interviewing the alt-right and other fringe online celebrities and just put him as this obscure figure with a website called www.starktruthradio.com, or has forgotten the old days of Voice of Reason Radio Network, where we had kooks like Carolyn Yeager and Stan Hess and just weird Trailer Park, Tom Metzger, William Pierce, Motorcycle Madness. I felt like, you know, at the tail end of Unite the Right and the collapse of it all, it seems like the Young Republican Kids Party doesn't even know this guy named Robert Stark basically promoted Richard Spencer and Greg Johnson and these kind of proto alt-right figures. And it really came from the kind of conspiracy Ron Paul Zionist ideals. And I feel like, you know, kids, they don't take things for granted. They think alt-right music is like Fash Wave and Xerius, and it's not like they know about like Def and June or Dead Can Dance. It's like people take things what's now and hip, and it seems like young kids don't know their history.
Yeah, because I was someone who was – I've sort of been there since the very beginning, and I was active far before the alt-right existed, but at the same time – I was never like fully in the sort of alt-right inner circle. I always existed kind of on the periphery, kind of like as an independent figure.
And like, I thought the most important part was, you know, I was a fan of your show when I was like 17, listening to the Voice of Reason Radio Network, and I'd be into really like, really weird stuff like Satanism and Nazi stuff and like gay fiction and like all these like radical stuff I liked as like in high school
even Peter Sotos.
No, that's kind of later, but I liked Trevor Brown and like Atari Teenage Riot and like weird like bands like Anal Cunt, you know, they're like shock art for shock. Oh, you enter a phase, like White House, you enter this phase where you're just like young, you're in high school, and you just wanna...
I thought my house was Peter Sotos.
Oh yeah, I mean later on, I just wasn't really aware of it. I was just you can't recall, like it's like you like Blackfield Brides or like any Blood on the Dance Floor, like these metalcore bands, and you really don't care about. I don't know how to explain it. It was just like being young and stupid, like Hot Topic core, and like. During that age, it's like I felt like a pervert for like listening to reading Holocaust Denial and stuff like that. And I like self-indulged myself in that as I was like in this like bad public school and like probably the same thing like Gnome and Journey of Vapor Island had, you know, full black high school or no, it was high school, middle school and just like chaos. And it's like you're at that. But anyway, it was more like I listened to it as a guilty pleasure. And as time rolled on, it became almost normie now. And I feel like I still, there's only a few people left in the old school pre-alt-right, you know, pre-Richard Spencer alt-right that remembers this past. Okay,
so my show was pretty mild-mannered. You're talking about those other shows that are kind of 1488.
Well, I mean, when I went to American Renaissance last year, I met Jamie Kelso and Mark Weber, and I told all about, you know, your show activity, and they were just curious because, like, they were amazed. Wow, you listened to the Voice of Reason back then. And I was like, yeah, I was really into that. And I just felt like that old generation didn't write anything down. I felt maybe great.
Tom Sunick, who was on VOR?
Yeah.
I met him in L.A., and I actually ran into him at an event in Germany. And, like, he had no idea who it was. He was like, oh, nice to meet you. Like, he was, like, totally oblivious.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be very professional with things. I mean, I've never met Sunick, well, but...
I think that Robert and the stark truth kind of always has like struck me as something that doesn't really get the credit that it deserves, because it's been around for like 10 years. And, you know, and I kind of touched upon this in like the afterword that I wrote, is that you've interviewed basically anyone who's anybody in the underground, like alternative, like political sphere, you know, over the last 10 years or so. Some of them, you know, long before they were got hit by the mainstream media or anything like that, before they became like these household names. And I always felt like this program doesn't get the credit for like how pioneering it is and just how much more substantive it is than these more like these kind of like firebrand podcasts, you know, like Christopher Cantwell or Fash the Nation and Daily Showa and these kinds
yeah
of,
I don't even bother.
Chapo Trap House.
I don't even like, bother listening to those. Basically, the only show that I watch, I do watch Luke Ford's show on YouTube, and other than that, I don't really listen to that many alt-right podcast.
It just exploded in like the past 5 years.
Luke show?
No, the podcast, like the alt-right podcast. Yeah. Now there's like millions of them, like they're like pulps you would find. And it's almost like the same logo of autistic people thinking like they're above the world. I don't know, it seems like now there's just fake YouTube celebrities and like tons of SoundCloud speaker podcast about a whole lot of nothing. It seems like that itself became a fad itself.
Not just that, but I feel like those podcasts are more like, they're really like activist podcasts, right? Like they're just, you know what I mean? Like on this show, like it's always been different because we would have interesting people on the show and really just learn about their ideas. It's not, we're like, you know, it's all a matter of like staying on message or we're going to get this person on, we're going to debate him and it's going to be a blood sport or something like that. Like none of that.
Oh,
bullshit.
Do you watch those internet
like,
blood sports on YouTube?
I mean, I watch parts of them. I mean, I hate that kind of stuff. I think it's cringy. Like I hate it for like the same reason that I hate like watching like media TV shows of that kind, you know, where you get two people on and they just kind of, have at it or something like that. I think that like one thing I've always liked about this show and kind of your interviewing style is when you have somebody on, it's not like, you know, oh, we're going to get this person on the hot seat, you know, and grill them. It's more like this person gets to come on and we try to learn about their ideas and their ideology and what motivates them. And then really like the audience can make up their own mind. It's not like, I mean, occasionally you challenge people on certain points, but it's more like to say like, well, what you know, what would you say to this kind of scenario or something like that? It's not a very like confrontational show, and it's kind of, it's more substantive. And I feel like this show has more value than those other shows that are really just kind of, they're almost just like entertainment, like Rush, you know, infotainment, like Rush Limbaugh or something. And that's what like Chapo Trap House and these other shows, these podcasts that are just hugely popular, like to me, they're not interesting at all. You know, and this show really hasn't gotten the kind of credit also for the longevity of it, which has been around for 10 years. And what happens to these other people is they start a podcast, it gets popular, and then, you know, the person, like, they get doxxed or they rage quit and flame out, you know, and the spiral into scandal. And this, you've kind of just kind of been like the slow and steady, the turtle, you know, that is just kind of like keeps going with the podcast and just like pretty much leaves all the drama and bullshit out of it. Occasionally there is drama, but it's more like you get these insane or lunatic fans that get upset about something, you know, and that's pretty much the, but it's not something that you respond to, you know, or you do shows that are like attacking this person or that person. Like it's absolutely never been that way.
Well, as far as my identity goes, for a very long time, I didn't really have a strong identity. I was just known as this guy on the internet who interviews random people and asks them about their ideas. But in very much in the kind of recent time frame, I'd say in the past 6 months, I'm starting to really develop a very strong identity. And there's a number of reasons to that. I think a major part of that is releasing my book, which expresses a lot of cultural themes in the show. And it's the book is a way, like my show is very mild-mannered and non-confrontational, but my book is very, it's very controversial and has a lot of shock value, but it works because it's done in a kind of manner of satire. But because of all these book reviews that have come out, it's actually gotten to the point that now there's this concept of the Starkian, and that was a word that was coined by the blogger Arian Skynet in his review of the book Journey to Vapor Island, basically defining Starkian as not just a political ideology, but also a visual aesthetic.
I mean,
yeah, that's true. And he does, one thing he does mention also is I think what I kind of tried to get at in the afterword, which is that he said that, like, he's come to kind of appreciate Stark's, quote, low charisma delivery style, and that it's become like one of his favorite programs. So it's kind of like one of those things where you kind of like you kind of come across almost like an unlikely hero. Even hero is not really the right word, but you know what I mean, right? Like you have this kind of unassuming guy that's really kind of building into something.
I'll ask this question to both you, Brandon and Francis. How would you define Starkian in several sentences?
You can go first, Francis.
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, if you were to release Journey to Vapor Island in 2012 or 2011 and a VOR, I don't think that would be allowed or accepted at the period.
In fact,
I think it would be an older audience that would say you would be working with the Jews and trying to make some deconstruction literature or something like that. And it still is like that today in some respect where I don't know. I made this point before as well that, you know, Keith Preston's Attack the System just felt like a system for radicals, but they were also associating and liking white nationalism, and they were trying to make it like hip, you know, like hipster racism or some hipster fascism. And I don't know. I just felt like out of all the shows on VOR, it seems like Robert Stark was getting in oh, there was that one guest, Sophia something, where it was just Sophia Theo. It was just some girl. Oh,
Theotaki, right.
It was just some girl. Now if you look for her website, it's all gone. She was just some slut from some college writing about game theory. I don't know.
Yeah, out of all the people I've interviewed on VOR, the only people I've stayed in touch with are Keith Preston, Anatoly Karlin, and Giovanni Donato. Oh, and Robert Lindsay, I don't have on the show so much, but I chat with him every now and then.
And then there would be, I remember even in 2012, there was that, I think there was this guy, I'm going to look his name up right now, he's like this Canadian, who would say like, I'm for the third position, and he would be basically talking about Family Guy on the show and making weird, it was so like 2000s. And yet it was like a 2012 show of the stark truth. I think it was some Canadian, and he was talking about the third position. I think his name was Stephen something. I don't know. I forget. But again, it was just...
Yeah,
like...
I interviewed a number of like third positionist types, but you didn't really answer my question. How would you define the concept of Starkian today in the year 2018?
Well, in 2018, this is what I'm trying to say. Whether it began on Stark Truth and you just getting random bloggers in a time that was before Vaporwave and before normies finding the internet, it seemed like Stark was a quintessential queer culture before it was developing. And I mean queer not like sexual deviancy. I mean it as in strange, as like weirdo stuff. And eventually... Now, because of that 7 years in development, you have a list of characters that have been on your show, which you can basically taint as, I was that guy on the Stark Truth show, that all invented these ideals, whatever it was, the alt-right or some post-anti-liberal theory. And I guess it would mean the people who are on Stark's program, or people who talk about Robert Stark, or just kind of have this little circle... where the creative arts are also anti-liberal but are jaded from that weird white nationalism 1.0 background where they're trying to grow up in an age of
technology. Or jaded from white nationalism 2.0 is more like.
Oh yeah, that's not advanced Robert Stark as well. I mean,
okay, we'll get to all this later. I'll move on to Brandon. Brandon Adamson, yeah. How do you define Starkian in the year 2018?
Well, I think it's like any kind of like a retro futurist aesthetic with a almost an obsession with city planning, left wing like social nationalism, sexual openness, and environmentalism. I would say that is what I would define as probably a Starkian, which is very similar to my own views, with maybe like race as a component of that, but not as a primary aspect.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. And when Arian Skynet defined it, he just sort of listed a bunch of like random topics that are discussed on the show, but those topics are kind of merging together. There's a new blog out called Alt of Center, and the guy who runs it, I'm going to have on the show pretty soon, but I would say that his blog is like the first official like new Starkian blog.
I would agree. Yeah. So.
And I think that all of our sites have kind of developed to where they're in kind of the same sphere. You know, I think that... that over time, that they've kind of that our whole crew has kind of developed into its own kind of cohesive, like fledgling, kind of area. Whereas, I mean, of course, other people have like come and gone, you know, like Alex von Goldstein. But I mean, the people who are kind of central here have kind of developed our own kind of little group. That's for the most part. On the same page with regard to a lot of things. I mean, Francis, you can kind of go wild sometimes, kind of a wild card, you know, things. But you know, because I watch like Francis's YouTube and like, you know, like, you know, sometimes he goes into like attack mode, you know, with certain people, and I'm just like, oh, I thought that was somebody he agreed with, well, you know, something like that.
In the past, I was like really big and reaching out to these big figures, and I do that every now and then. But I've gotten on to the point where I've developed my own kind of inner circle that shares a lot of the same like core cultural and political interests and values, and I'd rather just kind of focus on that, because you interview these people and they have these great ideas or they're interesting, but it's all about their identity. I want to focus the direction on the show as to building more of a core, unique political and cultural scene, which has already sort of established itself. And I think like this year, 2018, is especially like 2018 is the year of the Starkian.
Yeah, and also a lot of these larger figures now that maybe you'd have on the show in the past, now that like your identity, your views are more out there, like there are a lot of those kind of people that are so uptight that they would be like, they would actually be at the point where they would disavow you, you know, like that's kind of where we've got you. I'm kind of amazed that that you don't get more outright haters for, you know, some of the things that we promote on here. That you're able to get away with.
I'm like, the one that's been dealing with most of the flack. In fact, I think it's weird because when I go around talking about the Stark Truth, people think I'm kooky, and I've already met some figures.
Well, you're openly promoting miscegenation to outright white nationalists. What do you mean?
Yeah, I see.
And that's the thing too. It's like, but you have, but Francis, you also have like very like a taunting kind of personality. So like, if you like are going to be taunting people on YouTube, like fuck this guy, fuck that guy, I mean, you're going to get like,
oh yeah,
like
didn't you get into it with Brendelfly once on Luke Ford's stream?
Not even that. It's like Jim Goad. I've already made Margot Metroland, Greg Johnson. I felt bad for Greg. Well, I really did. That's a long story.
Greg,
that's a little private.
Brandon, didn't Greg block you on Twitter?
Yeah, he did for one like minor disagreement over, you know, he's been really big like in attacking that guy Tommy Robinson, and like almost like 80 or 90% of people have been like pushed back and disagreed with him on it, and like I just disagreed with him on Twitter, and then that was it. It blocked, you know, like after like years and years. And I don't know.
It's weird because, like, yeah, there are different. I've pretty much had a flock with now everyone in the alt-right where I said, you know, burn my bridges, I'm doing my own. But I think, well, as we're rewinding this, you know, Robert Stark just doesn't get involved with it. But if he got more involved and Stark was more, you know, approaching, there are actually a lot of people that hate on the Stark Truth. What I'm saying is I'm kind of the martyr for that. I've been basically acting as the shield to take all the bullets because I actually take pride in the Stark Truth. It's just that you'll find these weird far-right individuals that say, who this kike is and who are you? You're promoting. And I'm like, hey, fuck you, dude. And then it's just like I have to
but
be
they
this
don't,
kind
do
of...
Do they even have any basic intellectual argument of disagreement?
Not really. They just here's what the alt-right has been doing. They've been creating a deep state on the YouTube through YouTube streaming, and now like you have to be for their plan or they won't give you commercial exposure on like what JF, you know, that French guy now that's really popular. It just seems like you either play their game or you get blackballed in the system. And I feel like, well, there's no intellectual or artistic growth. It seems like a bunch of
we're like, you know, Our group is like, we're post all of that. Like, that's like all like basic bitch stuff, you know, in my opinion. That's like all of the stuff that like that I wanted to get away from. That's like why I started my site to begin with like 3 or 4 years ago. So the thing is like Francis, like you still engage with those people. Like I've gotten to a point where like if I know somebody is like antithetical to like the things I believe in, or that there are certain like deal breaker issues that like I just like I check out, man, and I just don't, I just kind of like, I write them off, you know. I don't go and, you know, once they say certain things and I'm just like, okay, well, those guys obviously like not on my side. Like, I'm just not even going
to
bother.
I mean, yeah,
with,
I have
this
to learn
group
more
or these,
about
these
that.
People.
But I've been more on the school shooter side where it's like, well, first of all, these people have called me mentally unstable. And one thing that hurts me is anyone calls me retarded or autistic, I snap like Jim Goat. I will snap and like basically stalk and show hate mail to people. And I've gotten to not only
didn't you call
fights,
me mentally unstable in the book?
Well, Robert, the difference is that's a little true. But anyway,
well, you know, but I think Francis, that like, I mean, you're a lot younger than I am, and like when I was your age, like I would have been at that level of confrontation. Also, of course, like I was luckier because like the internet wasn't as big of a deal in like 2002 in terms of like the way you could. There was like people. There wasn't even like YouTube, right? There was no video or like anything like that, so you'd just be like, you know, talking shit to some dude on a forum or something like that. Whereas like, but I think now that I'm older, like I just learned to just like, I just ignore people. I just like don't give a fuck, you
yeah
know? That's why
I'm
when
totally
like sometimes
same.
Robert will send me something like, you know, like, oh, this guy mentioned you on his blog or something. I'm thinking like, why? I'm thinking like, why are you sending me this? Like, I'm not going to read it. Like, I don't even pay attention.
Well,
I don't
was
even pay
same
attention
way.
To that. Like,
This was like before the alt-right. This was back more in the really kind of like early kind of almost like conspiracy theory days. But I had a phase where I would like go on online forums and get into all these online feuds. And this was back when I was like in my early 20s, even younger than Francis.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I can understand it. It's just like, you know, whatever. I do think that it actually has kind of built your brand a little bit, Francis, by starting these feuds with people. Is just kind of like,
well, guess what? Nick Fuentes, Sam Hyde have made those, basically they're extroverted individuals that they cracked the Jerry Springer code by creating trash TV and making it accessible. And that's basically now what the alt-right's motivated by. Well, I think the blood sport fad is now kind of dying out, but it shows you how easily these introverted, middle class out in Ohio bumfuckery people go by. They're just worthless kids who don't have a future.
Yeah, they're not intellectuals. They're going to have this brief time as like an internet, minor celebrity and then become irrelevant. Like with what I'm doing is I'm taking the kind of slow and steady path, but I do genuinely believe that this could lead to something great and possibly grandiose.
You know, it's even weird, Robert. I mean, I think a lot of this is associating with the whole, you know, talking shit is like the rap game. I mean, recently XXXTentacion got shot and he died at age 20 because he would get into verbal fights and there was this guy that wanted to shoot him because they, you know, because he was a famous rapper. You know, that's how the black community works by. And if you think about it, it's like a white people level of it. Like when I say, you know, Robert, you're like the new Adam Parfrey, Feral House, like apocalypse culture. The actual Adam Parfrey will butt in and say, no, it's not. This show's nothing compared to me. And then he dies. And then Juliet Parfrey, his sister, comes and calls me a robot. And Gideon Partridge. And then all of a sudden the Parfrey crew starts attacking me because I had him on your show. And then all this stuff happens where one little and the point is one little voice, one little association, wherever that's Jamie Stewart of Juju or something like that. And one fan base.
Jamie Stewart of Juju was responsible for that guy coming on. He was like a former leftist, and he's the guy who has the Alt of Center blog, and he's now sort of adopting a very similar cultural outlook to myself. And that's really that's really inspirational to actually get people, especially someone who's significantly younger, who looks up to you, and to have an influence. So it's not like a mass following that other people have, but I think it's really there's a lot of potential. I think what I want to go over is in the book, Francis, you did do like an interview of my background in history. I think a good place to kind of go over is just kind of like my life story, starting in my teen years, and how that's basically led to where I am today.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, it's, I mean, if you want to, I mean, I thought, you know, it would be interesting because, like, you know, it's just basically nobody really knows the biography of certain individuals. And it's important to know that because, again, it's like people only know you tuned into an individual named Robert Stark since 2009. But I didn't even know you were on internet forums at the age of 20-something going on saying, ah, the Jews burned. Now I'm curious. What was that forum name? I want to collect those
forum articles. What forum? I don't remember that.
Maybe you do. And then now I'm curious. Like, that's a part of Stark Truth. Stormfront. Oh, Stormfront? That sounds like a Stark Truth.
Maybe play. I did. If I did, it was only to troll them.
I think you've done that before.
Maybe, but
so
anyhow.
So Stark, why don't you give some background on your teenage years? Like, you know, give people a taste of, you know, of what's in the book. Like, you know, how did your teenage years get you to where you're at now?
Well, my political views have changed a lot, and part of that is because now I'm at the point where I'm like confident enough to just have my own ideology, which is now Starkian or Starkism, and I don't need to join a group. But throughout most of my life, I still felt that sense that you had to be part of a political team. So I was joining different political movements that I can go over. But just a kind of basic situation that I grew up in, which has shaped my world, my political, cultural outlook and worldview, is I grew up on the west side of LA, and I went to a high school that was pretty ghetto because it was in a nice area, but there were a lot of students bussed in, so I was exposed to that element of society. And I was also living in a fairly, I wouldn't say fairly, I'd say a very wealthy area, and I was exposed to a lot of wealth. And I had also, so I was really exposed to the whole kind of a class divide in society and the kind of demographic and ethnic dynamics in a place like LA. So that shaped my worldview. But even in high school, like I was not really, I didn't really subscribe to a political ideology, but I had maybe had some libertarian leanings, but I was sort of aware of things like just being in like a ghetto high school. And also not just high school, I went from like an elementary school that was really kind of nice and sheltered to a sixth grade. I went to a middle school where there were a lot of ghetto black kids bussed in. So I did experience racial bullying in middle school. And then I went to another middle school that was kind of a mixture of like kids from the ghetto who were bussed in with some like stuck up rich white kids. So I was sort of aware of all these economic, sociological, and racial dynamics. And then with a kind of Swipple cultural influence, I think that just comes from like my background. I mean, I have like a lot of creative types in my family, and I've always been exposed to things like art, going to like the art museum since I was a kid, eating at like ethnic restaurants like sushi or Thai, taking vacations to San Francisco. So I've always been fascinated with creative stuff, aesthetics, kind of things that are culturally sophisticated that are now called Swipple. So a lot of my core issues that I talk about were sort of shaped in my teen years.
Yeah, that's interesting because, and I can relate to this too, but so often when you have any, you express any kind of, I don't know, maybe like offensive or un-PC like racial sentiment, people are always like, oh, you know, you need to get out more and, like, actually meet some people. Of
oh, yeah, they assume they assume you're some hick from West Virginia who's never visited.
Yeah, that you're sheltered. And yeah, I lived in Los Angeles. Like, I'm familiar with diversity. Like, you know, that's why I developed these views was from actually being around these other kinds of people and listening to what they had to say.
The only good non-whites happen to act like white and, you know, please them. It's not like anyone, they're going to have sex with a black girl anytime soon.
So that experience also kind of reminds me a little bit about Journey to Vapor Island, kind of how the switching schools and the kind of someone like being a kind of like almost a ping pong ball between like these ghetto groups and also, but not completely identifying with like the stuck up, rich kids either.
Yeah, totally. Basically, Journey, I mean, I wouldn't go as far as to say I was like Gnome, but Journey to Vapor Island was heavily influenced by my teen years. I do have a story. Do you know the like Natalie Bloom bat mitzvah scene in the Journey to Vapor Island?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was actually inspired by a true story. So I wouldn't really call him a good friend. He was more of an acquaintance. But I knew this guy in ninth grade, and he was this rich kid from Beverly Hills, kind of like a caricature of kind of like a bratty rich kid. And he invited me to his bar mitzvah, and it was at this hotel called the Renaissance Hotel. It's on Pico Boulevard, just south of Beverly Hills. It's in that area kind of by where Luke Ford is, where all the Orthodox Jews live. And it's a really, like, cool, like, 1970s style high-rise. And it has this, like, exterior glass elevator and with this amazing view of the city. And I think even in my book, Journey to Vapor Island, like, I wrote about, like, the exterior glass elevator in the scene where Gnome is in the tower on the island. But I don't know about you, Brandon, but like, I'm a really big fan of those types of elevators.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a big fan of high rises in general, but I do like,
but it's like,
I do like that style of elevator. You see some of that in Las Vegas too.
Yeah. It's like, it's still, they did remodel it, but it's still like, it's a very 70s building, if you like 70s architecture. But anyhow, like, the story is he had, like, a cousin, and, I mean, she was blonde, so she kind of fit that type, like a Natalie Bloom. And I got, like, an obsessive crush on her from that, but I was just, like, I was really young. I was only in ninth grade, so I was just, like, way too shy to even talk to her, but I developed like an obsessive crush. So I kind of like, that's like ancient history. So that's not something I'm really thinking of, but I just took that story and I borrowed from it for artistic inspiration for the scene in the book.
When I was like in seventh grade, I had this like obsessive crush with this Brazilian girl. And then I wanted to learn everything about Brazil. I didn't even know what Brazil was, you know? And I would like go home and look at like art, like pictures of Brazilian girls on the internet. And then I think I found her like Blingy page or something.
She like Japanese Brazilian?
She was some Asiatic Brazilian, but like there was this thing called Blingy or something, and I found it, and I found like her, like she's probably back in Brazil or something, but like I found her page and then like I masturbated to it and it was like really good. But, like, this was like when I was 15 or something, or like 14 or something,
but I'll just say I was in this ghetto high school, and this is actually a different high school. The one before was actually a private school. This is a public school in West LA. But there was this girl, she was Estonian, and it was interesting with the school is there were very few pretty white girls, but the few that there were, they were mostly like immigrants from Eastern Europe, so she was Estonian, and she would hang out with the sort of popular crowd, and me and I brought my friend along, we would kind of, I would kind of gaze at her from a distance, kind of like something Gnome would do. And it's interesting about the racial dynamics there, because the school was like majority Mexican and with a lot of blacks, Persians, Koreans. And my best friend, he was actually Salvadorian, but we would just sort of we were friends from the track team, and I would mostly just sort of hang out with him at lunch, but I would always sort of check out like the popular crowd. And it was interesting as there were so few whites in the school, but that specific popular crowd was like majority white. And I would sort of like gaze out at her. And then like one time, like she actually had like this black baseball player come over and like confront me and tell me to stay away from like her crowd. So this is like totally like Journey to Vapor Island material.
Well, she got cucked by some black idiot. So fuck her.
Who knows? But the grand finale of this story was I had some friends who were they were Russian, and for some reason they knew her. So I met up with these Russian guys at this was grad night at Disneyland, and this was actually the very last time I went to Disneyland. So I just lucked out, and I was hanging out with them, and then she was hanging out with them. So I got to hang out with her just that one very last night. And prior to that, I had like no interaction with her whatsoever. So like I have all these like, and I don't know, like I don't even think I can like, after that, I don't even think I can go back to Disney. Like I wasn't able to even go back to Disneyland because like, it would bring back that memories, and that was back like in 2004. So I have all these like life experiences, which have given me all these like all this material for my book.
Dude, I would do like the same thing when I was like, I think it was like 14. When it would be like lunch, this is like middle school tier. This was like 8th grade or something, or like 7th grade. No, this is 6th, one of those grades. But we had AIM, American Instant Messenger. And, like, the girl that had, like, a crush on me, like, every lunch, I would, like, okay, there would be this table with, like, 5-6 seats, and I would be at this one table seating with all these friends. I didn't talk to them. So after I ate my lunch, I would slide my table and just look at her for 40 minutes for, like, I don't know, 5 days a week kept doing it. And then become, like, I don't know, she's out of a stalking, but I guess that's, like, little kitty stalking, you know? But I guess that's what you do when a boy has a boner and he doesn't know what to do with it.
So, yeah. I don't want my audience to think I'm, like, some, like, gnome or, like...
No, I'm just saying that's, like, my gnome shit. Like, I do, like, a lot of gnome stuff
like
that.
Like, I think all of us have a little bit of gnome inside of us, whether we like to admit it or not.
But I was, like, more, like, super gnome. And it's, like, I don't know. I can totally relate to that. But, like, I don't know. Maybe, like, this girl... I mean, I the last time I knew about her is like she has the same birthday as I, a year younger, and the last time I know she worked at Hooters. So yeah, she's pretty much like a dried out slut now, but like at this time when they're like MySpace, pre MySpace, you know. This was like a thing where I used to think like she was my soulmate or something and things like that.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Like I used to get all these obsessive crushes.
No, it was more like certain individuals, but I think after this girl, I like started to hate white girls because all of them were like fucking shit, and like I just ignored them as since then. I don't know.
So, kind of about my political. This is getting pretty personal, but kind of on my political evolution. So I took these cultural and political observations, and George Bush was president at the time when I was a teenager. And George Bush was one of the worst presidents we have, so obviously I didn't want to be a Republican. But I really despised like all these like phony, rich West Side liberals. And this also had like these college professors and high school teachers talking about things like white guilt and all this bullshit. So I didn't really want to be a liberal later. So I had some of the same views that I had now. But I kind of felt this need that I had to join a tribe. So my first involvement in politics was with libertarianism. And the first time I voted was in 2004 for the libertarian candidate, Michael Badnarik. And then in 2008, I got like heavily involved with the Ron Paul movement.
Oh, I was going to say that. I mean, that's very similar to like my own political evolution, I think, is because I was always, when I was younger, I was always a Republican, but I still didn't like really fit in with their, like my views weren't actually that different from what they are now. But like,
when I was even in like a college Republican club for a while, but I didn't even support the Republican Party. It was more like I was looking for like a social club, and I was just fed up with all these politically correct college professors. But I didn't necessarily support the whole political agenda of like capitalism and wars and all that nonsense.
Right. Well, I think that I did maybe until like part of the way through the Bush administration, when like that was when I kind of started to think that like it started to become apparent that like that a lot of these people were just full of shit, you know, that they didn't really have it. You can just see how much it's changed, really, from back then. Remember when it was like 9/11 happened and people were like, well, thank goodness we've got the Bush and this experienced defense crew, like they're really going to handle business. And then like it turned out that like they had no idea really what they were doing, you know, all of these people that were supposed to be like kind of the adults about things. But then it was like, I think even as far back as 2004, I was like kind of secretly rooting for people like John Edwards. I think I secretly kind of supported him.
Oh, I saw him in person at a Ron Paul rally when he was driving by in his motorcade and he was waving to his supporters.
Yeah. And so I think around then my evolution was kind of the same, is that by the time that I became like closer to having the views of the Democrats on economics, when especially as I like got out more into like the business world, people always say that like, oh, when you get older, you become a Republican. And once you get out into the business world,
but I had the opposite experience. I had the exact same opposite experience. Basically, I was a libertarian economically, even though like I didn't really care that much for like rich people. I still supported like libertarianism and libertarian economics, like Austrian economics. Then the older I got, I realized how corrupt like the capitalist system was, and how it's rigged.
Well, and how corporations will, that without regulations, like corporations will literally do everything they can to like, to manipulate you, and to also, they will do the absolute bare minimum of what like the regulation requires, and it's just like kind of just the way that they operate, where it's like they don't. Once I got into the corporate world, I just saw like how everyone's just like trying to put one over on you. You know?
Yeah, and, exactly. So then back to my evolution is then through the Ron Paul movement, I met a lot of interesting people. So I met like a lot of conspiracy theorists, both like the Alex Jones type conspiracy theorists. Those are super common. I also met some like anti-Semitic or anti-Zionist conspiracy theorists. Then I met some white nationalists. That was like my first exposure to white nationalists. And some of them were more even like kind of like the old school, like skinhead types. And then I had an Asian friend in the Ron Paul movement who showed me this book called Willis Cardo, Profiles in Populism. And that kind of, I did a lot of research on Willis Cardo and a lot of these different like populist icons he was talking about. I think he talked about like Huey Long and Charles Lindbergh, and that kind of exposed me to like new ideas that were kind of beyond libertarianism. And then after that, I went through more of like a paleoconservative phase where I got into Pat Buchanan, sites like American Conservative. Then I started like reading like American Renaissance and stuff like that.
I remember the first time I viewed American Renaissance. I think it was 17. I thought it was some like child molester website. I'm serious. It was like the old like American Renaissance looked like NAMBLA website. It was like we're talking about when they used to have a banner on the left and it said, "Is Wikipedia a part of the Marxist enemy?" It looked like a bunch of old dudes where like they're trying to tell like some weird. And this is coming from like if you're endorsed with neo-Nazi stuff, you just think they're a bunch of old freaks who like want to prey on little kids. So, I know. This is what I thought.
The first time that I looked at American Renaissance was in around like 2002 or something when I was just kind of like in the early days. I would read sites like VDare and stuff, and I'd kind of read them like. Just more like curiously, like where it's like where you're kind of like secretly agreeing with things they say, but you kind of like, oh, this is like so icky, like why am I even looking at this, but you still want to look at it anyways. One of the first things that I remember is watching the clip on Amran where Jared Taylor is on the Queen Latifah show. There's a you could find that on YouTube.
Oh yeah, I've seen that.
That's what I remember from one of my earliest experiences looking at one of those edgy sites.
But it was like
so. I got involved with Voice of Reason, and that was kind of an extension of the paleoconservative crowd, and that was kind of a little bit more like VOR was definitely more radical than the stuff I was used to, and. But the thing is, like, I just really wanted to get on radio. I wanted to have a voice. And I met these guys online, and they were putting up this radio network, and I was really excited. So on Voice of Reason, I talked about a lot of different topics. I interviewed people about, like, immigration and HBD. I talked a lot about, like, third way economics. Things like distributism and social credit. I interviewed some of the like Manosphere types. I interviewed people like Andy Nowicki, and I interviewed Jim Goad back then. So it was more of a kind of an interviewing format. So with Voice of Reason. I interviewed a lot of really interesting people, and it played a really interesting, an important role in my formative years, developing my political ideologies. And I was just sort of in a stage of exploration. Like, my views weren't solidified, so I was just learning new ideas from new people, being intellectually curious. But at the same time, like, now I can just be myself. Back then, I felt this, like, urge to kind of join a political tribe and conform to their values. So basically back then I had like a lot of the same interests. Like I was interested in modern art and architecture and certain like degenerate sexual things. Like obviously I couldn't express those things in the show. I mean, I probably had a lot of the same ideas that were expressed in Journey to Vapor Island. And that was like held tight in my subconscious or in my kind of fantasies, but I just felt this like sense that I was in this environment of this was a traditionalist environment and we're fighting for traditional values. So even though I had my own views that kind of were not in line with that, but I sometimes transgressed against that because I would have Robert Lindsay on, and Robert Lindsay had like he would talk about these like controversial sexual issues, and sometimes it would get in, but then sometimes it would be like it would push the boundaries. So I rebelled a little bit, but
you would have those other people on, and they would kind of play the part of like. Of giving the opinions that like you were like too afraid to give, you know? So you would have him on or something like that. And it would be like him expressing those views.
Lindsay kind of played that role of like the degenerate, and I had to be like the straight laced journalist.
I always think that,
right. It's kind of like, it reminds me of when kind of these indie like media figures that are kind of controversial, like Gavin McGinnis or something like that. Like, they'll have somebody on their program that's like way more extreme than them, and you kind of wonder, like, are they like trying to really promote this guy, and they're just kind of like, you know, they're playing it like straight, but actually they're kind of publicizing him, and then they actually get accused of doing things like that when they have somebody on their program. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, I'm going to have this guy on my show. Like, I don't agree with him, but here, I'm going to broadcast.
Okay, so like one incident is on Voice of Reason, I interviewed this woman who was running in the Democratic primary for Senate in Connecticut, Lee Whitnum. And she was a Democrat, but she had some kind of like independent views. Like, she was critical of the Israeli lobby. And I think she might have been even critical of like the tech visas, but she was running as a Democrat, and the main newspaper in a city in Connecticut said Lee Whitnum like appears on like white nationalist radio. Then they're like, and this journalist like also had David Duke on the show.
You.
Yeah, exactly. But then Voice of Reason imploded, and the people involved that basically shut down, and now you can go on the site and it's not, you can't even access the audio files. And then Countercurrents kind of picked up on that. And Countercurrents is, I mean, it is very like a hardline white nationalist site, but what appealed to me about Countercurrents is they did have this kind of a artistic element that I didn't really find in like previous movements. And Greg Johnson was like going out of his way to promote people who were artistic. I would say that like on cultural issues and things like art and aesthetics, Countercurrents is probably more traditional than I am, but at the same time, they're like far more progressive than a lot of these other traditionalist types. Like, they'll have essays on Italian futurism, and then Greg Johnson wrote his famous essay West Coast White Nationalism, talking about like all these people who are nationalists, but they have like swivel cultural values. And a lot of the people who associated with Countercurrents, there were a lot of kind of like avant-garde types. And I mean, Francis, you've
Jonathan Bowden.
Yeah, Jonathan Bowden. I've actually met Jonathan Bowden like right before he died.
What did he say?
Yeah, he gave a really great speech. I didn't really talk to him that extensively, but Countercurrents had a lot of. It did that really appealed to me, and then from Countercurrents, I went on and did my own thing on Stark Truth Radio. And the very beginning of Stark Truth Radio was kind of a counter continuation of Countercurrents. But I got to this point on my show. I had that kind of a brief phase where like Charles Lincoln and Robert Lindsay were like regular co-hosts. But what it really was the stage when Alex von Goldstein came on, and I really started to shift things over to culture. And that was really the turning point when I started talking about things like retrofuturism. And we were doing like these movie reviews. Like, we reviewed Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, films like Taxi Driver, Solo, 120 Days in Sodom. So that was kind of the point where it became more of a cultural show, and using it as opposed to just like a political podcast. And Francis, you were telling me that someone told you that the Stark Truth is now like the official like hipster show.
Yeah, it pretty much is. I mean, because there was an ironic phase when Alex joined it where it became post Alex Goldstein became the show where it's like, well, the days of VOR is over. It's no longer hardcore white nationalism, nor it's on Countercurrents, and yet it's always been this weird show that would talk about again, as I bring up, there were actually fans of Stark Truth in 2012, 2013, and people would listen to it because they heard of hardcore politics, and it changed the culture, and then it's like it was everything. And it basically became the weird, as I put it, the weird fringe radio station. If you mix Wesley Willis and Lord Haw Haw together, you get, I guess, Robert Stark, where it has all these unique people, and you just find a file over there, and you get tainted by this person named Robert Stark, and it's like the cool kids club in a way.
Well, I think that would how the show transformed, because I was around during that period too, like even before Alex started coming on and co-hosting. Remember, like for a while we had kind of a good like three person.
Oh yeah, I think for like you 6 months. Even on in this old
I was in, like
when
I
Robert
was on,
Lindsay
like,
was a co-host. Yeah,
but I mean, I was on. You know, I probably co-hosted 20 or 30 of those shows with Alex, with you back then. And I think that the show transitioned to where, in the same way that our politics kind of transitioned to being more, more interest driven and aesthetic driven rather than strictly like ideologically driven, like the, so we started doing more shows about things we were interested in, regardless of really if they had anything to do with, and even on my site too, like instead of getting away from writing like these manifestos and things like that, I think the first like, article I did around the time back on my site, which was kind of a breakaway site, like I did a review of the movie Orca, which had absolutely nothing to do with anything. And I was just like, you know, I'm just going to, write about what I'm interested in, and like, you know,
yeah,
that's gonna
basically
times, like, it's gonna,
what
it's gonna,
I'm
in times,
doing
like,
is yeah. I just basically I talk about what I want to talk about, I write about what I want to write about, I take photographs of what I want to take photos of. This is like my show, and basically it's going to attract a certain kind of crowd who that appeals to, and I think it is appealing to a lot of people. But I'm sort of, a lot of it has to do with kind of maturing, because when you're young, you're still like exploring the world. But I've gone to the point where my cultural and political views are pretty much solidified. Basically, at a certain point in life, your tastes are pretty much like, you have certain tastes in things and they're not going to change dramatically. Possibly I will change in the future, but for now, I like the direction the show's going in. Just to kind of get, we're getting kind of close to the end, but do you think in a post-alt-right scene with the whole implosion of the alt-right, do you think we'll see the emergence of a Starkian alt-center retro-futurism that will replace it?
Well, I don't think it's going to it'll replace it, but the possibility for there to be a small like fledgling collective, I think, is pretty much inevitable. I think it's progressing toward that. Like this kind of group and cast of characters is kind of established.
And we're adding
identity.
Like,
we've almost fully broken away from everything else. Like slowly, you know, those bridges have all slowly burned. And I think that, but what you brought up just now, I think is important, because there are so many people who have kind of built up this kind of, oh, we don't trust anyone over 30. You know, that meme, like I've been seeing that a lot in terms of like, you know, keeping people away from these older activists and whatnot. And I actually feel that the opposite way from what I've seen is that a lot of these young people, they're like tourists, you know, so to trust these people, like, all of these people that come and end up being my fans or whatever, what have you, or people that like go like gung ho into these movements, like 6 months later, they're like totally disavowing everyone. And like, they're doing something completely different. Like I would say, like, you know, I'm more willing to trust somebody that's kind of seasoned and is kind of more set and they're kind of established, and not somebody who, you know, I'm going to go meet up with them and, because they're so interested in what I'm doing, and then 6 months later, they're going to like talk shit about personal things about me because I kind of let them in. And 6 months later, they've got some totally radical new ideology where they hate me and things like that. And I think I've seen that so many times that it's like, when you get these young people that are just like, oh, hey, man, I love your work and whatnot. I'm thinking like, okay, well, let's see where you're at in like 2 years. You know, just pace yourself, dude. Like,
so, yeah,
you know, I'm not going to go meet up with you.
We're basically at the end of the show. I think to wrap things up, I want to end the show on like one funny anecdote. So in that book, Brandon, in your final essay, you did write about our trip to Vegas. And
oh, yeah.
Basically, that place, the Emporium Shops at Caesar's Palace, that was my artistic inspiration for the Erotic Emporium and Journey to Vapor Island.
Yeah, and I remember that meeting, because that was like kind of where the very first place that we met up, pretty much.
You describe me as like a total neurotic head case.
Well, because I mean, I had never met like really anyone from, still haven't. I've never met up with anyone from the alternative political sphere, though many have tried to meet up with me or to make plans. So you're actually the only person that I was willing to meet up with. And so when you meet up with someone like that, you're thinking like, okay, just like, I wonder like, how crazy is this guy? Like, you know, is he going to be like, is this somebody that I could let into my hotel room, you know, or is he going to try to like spike my drink or something? Like, I mean, that's those kind of things
Robert,
are going through my mind.
That's two people that think you're mentally unstable. I'm just saying.
Well, no, and to continue like, but no, I didn't necessarily get that impression of you. It's just kind of like, cause you always read these stories about like somebody who people
oh,
in these
yeah,
movements that meet up
I
with each other.
I suggested I should fly to Phoenix and we take a road trip through like the mountains and in Arizona. And you were like a little bit like suspicious. I was a serial killer.
You're going to have gay
sex.
Yeah.
I'm thinking like, you know, I don't really want to drive through the desert with someone like I don't know at all or something like that. And, but not just that. So when I met up with some of the kind of the ways that I kind of portrayed it in the afterword is that like you were I mean number one you that you were like a picture taking maniac, like I mean this guy like
well, that's
you know,
that's
he wanted, yeah I mean you wanted to take a picture like every 5 seconds. I'm the kind of guy like I could go on like a 2-week vacation and I took like 3 pictures
and yeah
and like,
did have a panic attack when my camera's battery shut down.
Yeah, and then like Robert was also kind of offended that I mentioned that he was a loud eater, but like I didn't really intend to like say that's kind of just like an inside joke because like since I've often written that I'm kind of I have this weird paranoia or like obsession with like just hating the sound of people eating, so it's like a huge like pet peeve for me because of something. Like it was a big thing in my childhood because my stepdad was kind of a tyrant. And when I was a little kid, he made me like go in the bathroom and like watch myself eat in the mirror, like until I could like do it to his satisfaction. So it's like, it's one of those things where like, if I eat with someone and they're like at all loud or something like that, it's even if they're just like doing kind of like normal things, it's just kind of like I can hear like it's someone bite into a chip, like if they're on the other side of a restaurant. And I'll just
we're at the end of the show, but I just got to say that hopefully our next big podcast will be recording from like a top of the art radio studio at the penthouse at the Vapor Inc. Hotel on Vapor Island.
Oh, that sounds good.
Radical.
Okay, so it's been a great show. Thank you, Francis Nally, and thank you, Brandon Adamson, and go out and check out the new book.
Awesome. Sounds like you're great.